Rice. While we can make it in a matter of minutes in the microwave, it actually takes a lot of work, water, and up to 5 months for a crop to mature. On this episode of the Oxford Sparks Big Questions podcast, with our planet needing to make more food than ever to feed all of us hungry, hungry humans, we are asking, how do you grow rice faster? Hello, I'm Emily Elias, and this is the show where we seek out the brightest minds at the University of Oxford, and we ask them to weigh in on the big questions. And for this episode, we are off to the Department of Plant Sciences.
What do you like better, popcorn or rice cakes?
Rice cakes.
Really? Yeah. Why?
I don't know, they're just better.
To meet a woman who's all about rice, corn, and where they intersect.
I'm Jane Langdale. I'm a professor in the Plant Sciences Department.
What do you study?
I'm looking at how leaves develop and how they evolve. And I did my PhD in human genetics, but I got frustrated with the fact that if you want to do genetics, you need to be able to do crosses. You need to be able to make mutants, and you can't do that with humans, whereas you can with plants. So I switched from human genetics to maize genetics and started working with maize.
Or corn, as people like me call it. And you're probably thinking, Emily, why are we talking about corn on a rice podcast? But you gotta understand how important corn is. Jane has been looking at this plant since the 80s. Corn, or maize, is one of those plants that is very difficult to understand. And because of that, researchers gravitate towards it.
The reason I started working with maize was because it has a really good history of genetics. So Barbara McClintock, who got the Nobel Prize for discovering transposable elements, which are these jumping genes, she did all that work in maize. A lot of the very early genetic concepts that we now take for granted were discovered in maize. And so that's why I started working on it. But what I was working on was trying to understand how leaves are patterned. So maize is a grass, the same as the grass in your lawn, same as rice, same as wheat. And if you think about all of those different species, then the leaves look pretty similar, right? They're long, they look like straps, they've got a pointy end. But in fact, inside of those leaves, there's two very distinct patterns. And so maize and sorghum and sugarcane have one pattern, and wheat and rice and barley have a different pattern. And the difference between the patterns is how close together the veins that run along the leaf are spaced. And that sounds like a very trivial difference, but it's actually a very significant difference because it goes along with a difference in the way in which the plants photosynthesize.
Scientists have divided these plants into categories. The corn and sugarcane, they are called C4 plants. Rice, wheat, barley, they fall into the C3 plants. And they notice that in the leaf pattern of the corn, or C4, the ones that are super close together, they're better at growing at higher temperatures and produce more food.
There's only about 3% of species that use this pathway that maize uses, but they're responsible for 25% of global carbon productivity. So that's just because they're so much more efficient. So the majority of plants you're looking at are all doing the same thing as you thought they might be doing, that you probably learned in school, and that was the basic C3 photosynthetic cycle, as it's called. The energy that is used for photosynthesis is so much less in a C4 plant than a C3 that it means you get more yield. You get more bang for your buck, basically, in a C4 plant.
And researchers were like, hey, wouldn't it be great if we could manipulate the genes in plants like rice, wheat, barley, and get it to grow like corn? So for about a decade, Jane was trying to figure out the pattern of the genome of corn as it grows so she could break it down.
Essentially, in those experiments, we were mutating the genome. So we were using chemical mutagens or transposable elements, these jumping genes that jump around the genome, to try and essentially change the genome. And then what you do with the population of these plants, all of which had got different changes in the genome, you'd plant them out, grow them up, look at the leaf. It's going to look the same on the outside, so we had to cut it and look on the inside and just see whether or not the pattern was changed. over and over again.
How labor-intensive was this process?
It was very labor-intensive, very labor-intensive. We found some things that we weren't looking for that we did pursue, and in fact were very interesting. But in terms of the big picture question, you know, I just said enough is enough. We have to stop. We can't keep going at it this way.
In the mid-90s, the project was shelved, and Jane moved on.
Over a couple of years, I essentially diverted into still thinking about leaves, but thinking more about how they develop in plants that evolved early during land plant evolution. So things like mosses and liverworts and ferns and other plants that are not flowering plants. I started to look at the mechanisms that we did know worked in flowering plants, which were not actually anything to do with this patterning of C4 leaves. We started to look at those and how they were conserved during early land plant evolution, which was exciting in itself. And so we did that for 10 years or so.
Then, on one fateful day in 2006, Jane's phone rang. It was a scientist from the International Rice Research Institute.
Called about 15, 20 of us together for a few days in the Philippines and said, look, is now the time to try and propose making C4 rice? And we're all like, you know, well, that's a bit of a crazy idea. And I was like, well, I'm stuck on the anatomy. But then I started to think about it a bit more. And what had happened in between times was that technology had moved on such that it was now possible to take a sample of a leaf and extract nucleic acids from it and sequence those nucleic acids so that you could work out every gene that was switched on at that particular time in that particular tissue. And so what we were able to do was take different stages of leaf development in leaves that had a C4 type pattern and leaves that had a C3 type pattern and look at every single gene that was switched on at each stage and compare them. And from that, over the last few years, what we've been doing is whittling down those candidate genes to try and understand which ones actually do play a positive regulatory role in making that C4 pattern.
We see this more rice.
Centrifuges whirring in the background. Here you go, look.
And where they were once completely stuck, now Jane and her team say they've whittled it down from 30,000 genes to just 20.
So we're pretty happy with that. It's still going to take 5 to 10 years to work out exactly how this pattern is generated in maize. And then, once we know that, we can then try and engineer it in rice.
This is now Jane's primary focus of research. And with climate change and an increasing population, getting rice to grow like corn is more important than ever.
Rice, Asia is totally dependent on rice. Some countries, Bangladesh, for example, 70% of the calorie intake is through rice. 3 billion people depend on rice for survival. And in terms of the scientific problem of trying to convert C3 to C4, C4 has a much greater advantage over C3 in conditions where temperatures are high. And so rice is often grown in countries with high temperatures. And so we could have tried it with wheat first, but wheat is grown in primarily temperate zones. That doesn't mean to say that if we work out how to do it, we won't be able to apply it to wheat ultimately. But rice was the most obvious choice because it's the one where we know that we've got to increase yields by 50% by 2050 in order to keep up with the rising population in Asia.
Jane says the same amount of land that was used to feed 27 people in 2010 will need to feed 43 people in 2050. And so if you figure out how to turn rice into a C4 plant, this problem is essentially fixed almost instantaneously. Plus, it would require less water, less fertilizer, and work at higher temperatures. So basically, a massive win.
I'm going to crack it in the next 10 years. That's my goal. So I started working on this in 1985, had a bit of a 10-year break where we couldn't make anywhere, but I think we can do it. I think we're going to do it in the next 10 years.
Just in time for Jane's retirement. And if she manages to keep billions of people fed in the future, I say she deserves a pretty massive retirement party. So we should probably all just start planning now. This podcast was brought to you by Oxford Sparks from the University of Oxford, with music by John Lyons, and a special thank you to Professor Jane Langdale. Tell us what you think about this podcast. You can go to Twitter and tweet us at Oxford Sparks. You can find us on Facebook, or you can go to our website, oxfordsparks.ox.ac.uk. Or better yet, why don't you just tell your friends that this podcast exists? Or, ooh, leave us a rating on whatever podcast app you use. It actually helps other people find us. I'm Emily Elias. Bye for now.